It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, August 17th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the oh-so-fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, it's Casual Friday. He's never casual, but we have him on anyways. Cliff Schechter. Also on the program today to give me some movie selections, he writes for Totally Biased with Kamal Bell. His name is Hari Kondabolu. Very funny. Well, I guess we'll see about that, but very smart. So I am anticipating a good movie selection from him. Also on the program today, It's hard to distinguish, but apparently in Russia, members of the punk rock band Pussy Riot have been sentenced to prison for 2 years, including time served, for speaking ill of Putin in a Russian Orthodox church. And we have protesters in New York who have been arrested as well under an 1800 or a almost a 150-year-old law about wearing masks like those worn in Russia, or something to that effect. Also, Todd Akin, Republican candidate in Missouri, explaining why he will not win, but doing it in the form of crapping on kids' capacity to eat while in elementary school. And all sorts of shenanigans going on in the what's that thing that's happening? That presidential race. Indeed, that and more. But first, we've got to take a little break and introduce the... first, we've got to go to Cliff Schechter, which means Cliff Schechter's theme song. Hello, listener of the Majority Report. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. You can get a free Audible book download right now at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. David Rakoff just passed this week. We ran an interview with him earlier in the week. Why not pick up his Don't Get Too Comfortable by David Rakoff as a free Audible download book at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Pick up Rakoff's last book, audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Do it now.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, proving that this guy is missing the boat without not writing jingles. Jimmy Reefcake's Cliff Schechter song introducing the one and the only Cliff Schechter. Hello, Cliff.
Sammy, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. You've been very busy.
I know. Radio here, radio there. I'm trying to take over all your gigs, man.
I appreciate that. As long as they keep sending me a check, I got no problem with
that. Really? Maybe they're sending you the check they're supposed to be sending me.
Yeah, probably. And I got no problem with that either.
It's funny because I go on these shows, but nobody pays me.
Yes, believe me. I understand the dynamic. Oh, yes, I understand the dynamic. Well, Cliff, you know, so much has happened since we last talked. Of course, last week I was on vacation. We had mostly archive shows, specifically for members. So last week was sort of a dead week anyways. But on Saturday morning, I think it was at like 3 a.m., the Romney campaign decided to announce who their vice president
the digital news dump?
Well, you know what's weird about that? I don't want to harp on this too much, but I think there's going to be a story about how they pick. There's going to be another HBO movie about how they picked Paul Ryan, because weren't they really harping on how they were going to announce this? You had to download a Romney app or something, and we're going to announce it on the app, and then they just sort of seemed to blow that whole thing off.
Yeah, there's something going on there. It's obvious because when you read sort of a number of accounts of what happened, it seems like everybody besides Romney on his campaign realized that Paul Ryan shouldn't be the VP pick.
Well, it's not just and that he, it's not just on his
he
campaign.
Overruled him. But I'm saying I think that he just maybe he leaked it so that they had to go with it. I'm having fun, but seriously, I think honestly there are a lot of people. It's kind of like Palin split everybody. Because there are a lot of people like, this woman's crazy, and others are like, well, we need her. I think there are a lot of people that didn't want it to happen. Who knows? Maybe that's why it leaked. I don't know. But it did leak out pretty quickly there Friday night.
I mean, we could have this conversation sometime in December. But I think that, I don't even think that the people who were rooting on, like the National Review and et al. And Bill Kristol, all these people who were supposedly pushing Romney to pick Ryan – I don't even think they wanted Romney to pick Ryan. I think they wanted to stake their claim right now, a month and a half or whatever it is, 3 months, 2 months before the election, that this is why Romney lost.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right.
I think the only person who wanted Ryan, although it probably applies to both, was Romney. My whole theory is just that this guy knew that he had a high probability of losing. And if he was going to lose, I mean, just for a moment, let's just do this thought experiment, because I want to get into what's actually sort of relevant to us in this pick. And what I know we're on the same page of this because of that that Biden piece you sent me. But I think that Romney thought experiment. Romney picks Pawlenty, or Romney picks Port. Oh, we just lost him. That was weird.
This mailbox is unable to accept voicemail messages at this time. Please try again later.
Hey. He probably is still on the line and doesn't realize. Now he knows they're disconnected.
Please try again later. Goodbye.
Hello?
Hello.
Ooh, that was good music.
That was weird, dude.
What happened?
I don't know, but your voicemail is all filled up, just FYI.
Yeah, we don't really use this phone for much. I think that's the problem.
All right, so let me jump back in where I was. I think that Romney saw that he had a high probability of losing. Here's the thought experiment. He picks Pawlenty. He picks Portman. He picks whomever, one of those guys. The guys that we expected him to pick, the do no
pasty
harm
white dudes.
Right. Are you going to – who is going to get the blame for losing that election? It's going to go fall square on Romney. I mean, do you – for instance, do you remember – quickly now. Do you remember who Dukakis' VP was?
I lost you for a second. Do I remember who's VP?
Do you remember who Dukakis' VP pick was?
I do, Lloyd Benson.
Well,
but,
yeah, I do too. But I think most people don't.
And but most people, I think very much most people don't. And you're right. People don't vote for the VP in the end. They vote for the guy at the top.
But when Romney loses, a year out, 2 years out, 3 years out, people are going to remember that Paul Ryan was on this ticket.
And you're saying you think it'll be different this time? Yeah. Well, I think that's why
Romney picked him. Because he didn't want to over this cliff by himself.
Yeah, I mean, Lloyd Benson may have been sort of a guy, I mean, just to go with the one you brought up, may have been a guy that had achieved a lot and was well-known and was sort of the guy that worked across the aisles or whatever. But he hadn't, but in a way, that's what made him blend in the Washington of that time. He hadn't sort of already created his own brand, if you will, right, by putting together a crazy budget so people were already having him on all the shows to talk about it. You're right. I mean, Ryan was kind of his own guy before Romney put him there. So I think you're right. I think there's a lot more chance that people remember and say, well, it was Ryan that took him over the edge. And really, even if they don't, I think you're right in that that's what Romney's attempting to do,
right,
which is deflect blame.
Yeah, I really do think so. But now let's talk about let's put
now,
that.
I do think, to be clear, I just want to say one more thing. I do think he actually also likes him because they're both dorky guys who think that they're cool.
Yeah.
And there's something to that, too. And think they're smart and think they're better than the rest of us and are rich and pretend that they're regular people and don't do it very well and the whole rest of the thing. So I could see why they'd get along. I mean, in a way, Paul Ryan is just a 30 year younger version of, no, 20, right, of Romney. That's really what it comes down to in the end.
Now, let's talk about, let's analyze this from the perspective of what's going to happen, what could happen after the election. I mean, I think we both sort of feel at this point, if we had to make a prediction, that President Obama is going to win re-election. And I think there's going to be two things. This could go a couple of different ways. It seems to me that while the Obama campaign is probably very happy about Paul Ryan as a pick, and while certainly anybody trying to reelect Democrats in the House and the Senate is probably even more happy about Paul Ryan as a pick. I think the Obama administration, you're starting to see a little bit of it. You saw it the first couple of days, is they're trying to make this about his, on some level, they want to keep that theme alive that Paul Ryan is an obstructionist and he is what stands in the way of the grand bargain. And that one of the benefits they're going to see is that he hopefully will be diminished after his loss, although maybe he'll be perceived as the
new leader of the party.
Yeah, but it seems to me that the Obama administration already tried to make him the leader of the party, you know, a couple of years ago.
Well, he elevated him because he wanted a foil,
right?
It seems to me, right?
And he wanted a foil who was going to allow him to seem reasonable by going in and offering the grand bargain. Which takes us to that Joe Biden piece. I mean,
plus, wouldn't you want Paul Ryan as your foil? He is kind of dreamy.
Indeed.
And, you know, the whole P90X thing. I mean, I can't get enough reading about that. Just, you know, I mean, just knowing what a working out to the oldies kind of guy Paul Ryan is, it immediately makes me like him.
That P90X thing apparently is, like, pretty hardcore. I could never do that.
I wouldn't even think about doing it.
All right, well, give me your notion. I mean, you sent me that that Biden thing. Let me hear what your perspective is on this.
Well, I mean, I obviously the most important thing is that they're trying to differentiate themselves in very clear ways from Paul Ryan and his ilk, from the Ayn Rand version of the world. And it seems pretty clear that they get it, you know, and they get that Social Security is popular, unbelievably. You know, the grand bargain, we often sit here and wonder what the hell they're doing there. And when I say that, I mean the Obama administration and some of the insider Democrats, too. And it's good to know, in a way, that they seem to understand that this is a hugely, Social Security, Medicare, these are hugely popular programs and hugely important programs. I mean, you have to remember what Biden came out and said is he said, I flat guarantee it. It'd be interesting to see them try to, if they try to walk that back later on. I mean, you know, he's sitting in a campaign stop in a cafe in Virginia and twice in a row says, I flat guarantee we won't touch it. So that's a great way to differentiate yourself from the madman on the other side who in his first, you know, iteration of his budget and, you know, in 2004, I believe it was going to take 50% of Social Security and privatize it. And it was going to cost $2 trillion. And even the Bush people responded that it was irresponsible. Again, being called irresponsible by the Bush people, right. I mean, come on. That's like being called a parasite by the cast of True Blood. So in a way, I was heartened by that because it doesn't seem like they're doing this stupid, you know, well, we've got a reasonable plan that cuts some from Social Security but also balances the budget. He just wants to destroy it. It was that we flat guarantee it. What I worry about is, of course, in 2008, President Obama ran a lot of that rhetoric too. You know, I remember hearing a lot about how they were going to renegotiate NAFTA. Instead, we've gotten like three more so-called free trade agreements. And I could go on other issues, of course, too. You know, so, I mean, I think it's important in, for the long term that we back – right, it really, it's all good politics and good policy to back up what Biden said right now and say, absolutely. We will protect it forever. It's the crown jewel of the New Deal. It's the best, you know, the best anti-poverty program ever created. It, you know, in the United States, anyhow, it is the biggest social insurance and program for children, such including somebody named Paul Ryan, who lost his dad at an early age and used the money from Social Security that went to him as a survivor so that he could put it away for college. All that stuff is stuff that I think we need to point out, because then eventually when I do think Obama will win this election, we need to make sure that they stay away from going anywhere near this thing just because, like, the people that watch Morning Joe will like it.
Are you concerned that we haven't heard the same thing in terms of Medicare?
Yes, there's no doubt I am. Because when you say it about one thing but not about the other thing, it's definitely somewhat concerning. And let's go beyond that, Medicaid. You know, and some other programs. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of other programs there that can be slashed too, that provide a variety of services, health care and other things, veterans benefits. I mean, you know, Ryan wants to go after everything except for defense spending. If you're a human being that needs help, well, obviously if you're rich, it's a little different. But if you're most human beings that need help, you're in that budget, you get destroyed. Luckily for you, however, if you are a corporation, like a defense contractor, it's rock and roll, which is why that budget, the first minute you take a look at it, it's a joke from the very beginning, because anybody who claims to want to balance the budget and raises defense spending from its already ridiculous place, at that point, you should take the budget not seriously in the slightest bit. But, I mean, so to get back to it, I mean, you know, he's talking about cutting all these programs. I'd like to hear them tell me they're not going to cut, you know, veterans' health care. I'd like to hear they're not going to cut Medicaid. I'd like to hear they're not going to cut Medicare, of course. And maybe we do our best to try to push them as far into a corner on that as you possibly can. Because, again, we may want Obama to win. These people may be crazy. But I promise you, you know, whatever you think you can get, you the promises you're going to get now, you're not going to get after he's elected and no longer needs you.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's the thing, is that I would like to see a lot more. And I want to say one thing about Medicaid that people should really understand, that the biggest cohort of recipients of Medicaid are retired people who essentially blow through all their assets and leave Medicare for Medicaid when they're in a nursing home. That is one of the biggest cohort of people on Medicaid. It is not, you know, and then essentially children. I mean, between children and elderly who have blown through their Medicare, you're talking almost about three quarters of the Medicaid program. This is something that I don't think is put out there enough, because there is, you know, in this country, crapping on the poor is sort of just like, you know, it's a hobby, and it's like it's the last thing that's mentioned. And I think, you know, people need to understand the relevance of Medicaid to people's health in retirement, and basically they're keeping them off the streets. I mean, that's what gets you into a nursing home. And I am just, you know, I've seen the way this has played out over the past week, and I feel like, you know, this is one of those times where the lack of resources and the lack of genuine independence of left and liberal, or however you want to describe these groups, that these issue groups is problematic, because this week. And, you know, it's going to be less so over the coming week, because now we're in sort of like the pre-convention mode. This is when we should be seeing the mobilization of groups that are protecting Social Security, that are protecting Medicare, going out and really trying to force Democrats up and down the ticket into essentially making that same pledge that Joe Biden made, where they should be going out there and making the stark difference. And to a certain extent, I think the Romney...
That's right. I agree. We should go Grover Norquist their asses on this.
It should be full on Grover Norquist. And it's almost as if, like, the, you know, nobody expected Paul Ryan to be the nominee. Nobody expected this opportunity that is sitting there, it seems to me. And it's really the only thing that's energized me about this campaign is that there's actually... We can actually get some leverage and make this campaign about what happens in the fall or in the beginning of 2013 in terms of putting, you know, it's not enough, but it's something to have Joe Biden out there saying flat out, no changes to Social Security, no changes, not just no slashing, not just no massive cuts, but no changes.
Right, and flat guarantee. I mean, it's harder to get out of that than we're going to keep the Social Security program the strongest, as strong as possible, blah, 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 which, right. You know, the fluff kind of stuff.
Right.
But we also have to all remember that there are a whole lot of people who said in very clear terms that they weren't going to vote for a health care bill without a public option.
Right.
And they did. So, what I'm saying here is that doesn't mean you should be demoralized. It means you have to get these people on the record as much as possible, numerous times, very clear, you know, and do your best so that there's a clear record there that is going to hurt them. And truth is that it's even, in a way, more important for members of Congress because not more important, but in terms of the electoral schedule, because they've got to run for reelection in 2 years.
Yep.
And they don't get to hide away for 4 years or 6 years afterwards.
And, of course, the difference between this and the public option is that there is virtually no controversy as far as things can go as no controversy in this country as to whether or not people want Medicare and Social Security untouched. I mean, you know, we're talking about 70, mid-70s, low 70s, high 70s in all the polls. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. These are, you know, this is
some of them go well into the 80s too.
Right, right. And so,
I mean, 76% of self-described Tea Partiers in a Marist poll, that's the one I like to pull out most often, said they didn't want anybody touching their Social Security. I'm sure to them that includes the government, but point being, yes. don't touch my Social Security. I mean, when you get that from the far right, because again, Tea Partiers are older white guys who hate benefits going to the undeserving folks, but they like their own stuff too. So if you can combine people like you and me who believe that everyone should get their benefits with the people who are somewhat more selfish and say, well, I should, well, that we come out ahead then very much so on Social Security and Medicare.
And what do you make of this, like, you know, this 716? I've been frustrated a little bit because I've just been watching too much time, I think, by you know, proponents, I guess, or protectors of Social Security and Medicare, and Medicare in particular, obviously, you know, getting caught up in the 716, and it's a bullshit comment, but, you know, the Republicans...
The Medicare cut comment?
Yeah, they, you know, the Republicans came out very strongly with this about Obama robbing from Medicare, and to a certain extent, I think it's worked because it's had to be addressed so much, as opposed to, you know, I guess I've dipped into... you know, the MSNBCs and CNNs and et al. A little bit more than I probably should for my own health over the course of this week. But just watching people, you know, I can understand, like, you know, on Monday I went on Spitzer's show and he asked me about that and I addressed it. But, you know, the people watching Currents, it's a different cohort at that point. People listening to this show, I explain it because it's a different cohort. But, you know, when people are on CNN And they're saying they're having to parse out the 716. You know what you say is you say the 716 is in both their budgets and they are cost savings. The bottom line is that Ryan and Romney will destroy the program after that.
Right. I mean, the difference is that that's one of the few good things Paul Ryan's budget does. That's corporate welfare. That's the Medicare Advantage stuff that goes to the private insurance companies.
Right. Unfortunately, the most inefficient Medicare. He cuts that money and puts it towards tax.
Right, that's what he does with those savings. I'm just saying that, you know, that's the part. It would be such an easy message to point out that that's actually the one part. Medicare is one of the most efficient healthcare programs in the world. Well, that's one of the parts, few parts of it that's inefficient. Why? Because that's the part where we do what we do with most of our healthcare, which is pay off private insurance companies.
Right.
You get rid of that part, and you keep the government, really the government part. And it gets much more efficient, magically. I know, because I know private business is always more efficient than government. But that's what happens here. So, first of all, you've got Paul Ryan having that in his own budget, obviously. Second of all, you've got Mitt Romney, of course, lying because he makes it like Obama's gutting Medicare and it's going to cut benefits for people, and it's not. And I got to tell you, though, if the media did its job all the time, then you're right, Sam. We wouldn't need to address this. But you do. What I like about the Obama campaign is they stayed on offense on this stuff. They've talked about them destroying Medicare, changing Medicare as you know it, and the rest. But you do have to defend. And I've watched a few different places this week where I do have to give credit where I normally wouldn't. You know, the 14-term on-and-off governor of Iowa, who's like 112 years old, Terry Branstad, went on Chuck Todd's show and started spouting these falsehoods. And right. To give Chuck Todd credit, he actually sat there and he kept saying, you know that that's been discredited and that's not true. Soledad O'Brien had to deal with the raging John Sununu, who, by the way, I love. The only thing that will upset me about this campaign if Romney loses is that we lose John Sununu. Like, I'd pay money just to see him on TV every week with his head bulging and the vein about to explode. And, I mean, he's like a WWF character. You know what I mean? He's the great Sununu or something. He's just awesome. He sat there and tried it. He tried to bully her. And to her credit, he said, oh, you might as well just have an Obama sticker on your head. And she pointed out all the nonpartisan places that said that he was not telling the truth.
Right.
You know, I mean, so it sucks, but, you know, it's much worse if you sit there and somebody says, hey, dude, you shot yourself in Vietnam just so you could get out of service, and you faked those medals and the rest, and then you're John Kerry's team. You're like, hey, it'll just go away. Let's ignore it for a month
right.
or two.
Right.
You know, you do have to address this stuff. So I'm glad that they've taken it upon themselves to do it. But you don't let yourself become distracted and say, well, now we're just going to – we can't walk and chew gum at the same time, so we're just going to answer these false charges. No, you the way you do it is you parry those false charges and you use them to go on the offense. You say, not only are these guys lying, but these are the guys that are going to destroy Medicare. They're going to give you a voucher. As healthcare costs go up, you'll be responsible for an additional $6,500 for your medical costs. Does that sound like a good gig to you? Well, taxes on capital. Gains and interest and dividends are eliminated. Mitt Romney has a 0.82% tax rate, so he can actually, for once now, for the rest of his life, actually keep his taxes in the United States because it's been turned into one big Swiss bank.
Speaking of Romney's taxes, I want to pivot here to this because I think this story is not over. And I think, you know, part of the reason why they were so – I think they so quickly – I think part of the reason why the Ryan rollout was as weird as it was because they were – I think Romney is just – I think he's terrified about what's in his taxes at this point.
Yep. I agree, and I'm becoming more convinced that it is. And again, I've got no proof, so let's be clear. But circumstantial evidence has sent a lot of people to jail in the past. So let's also be clear about that. I think you look at the evidence, and it becomes clearer and clearer to me that when he said the other day that I've never paid less than 13%, which if that's on a comical point in a campaign where somebody has to say I've never paid less than 13%, somebody who's worth than $250 million, that in and of itself should be laughable. But okay, he said that. Well, you know what? If he's not willing to sit there and blatantly lie to a camera, which he's proven himself willing to do too, that actually could be true. And he still could have, the guy who told Harry Reid he paid 0%, that could have been accurate too. And how could that be true? There's that tax amnesty thing.
Yeah.
All these guys that had their money in places like the Caymans and the Swiss banks and Luxembourg and all the other tax havens around the world in October, they had it till October of 2010. Magically, it's like almost like a coincidence or something that he was willing to release 2010 taxes, but not 2009.
Yeah, you know, I mean, why just to remind people what you're talking about, in 2000, early 2009, there was a whistleblower from the UBS Bank in Switzerland who basically said, hey, to the U.S. government, you know, there's a ton of people here. Maybe not a ton, but there's a sizable amount of people here who have sort of these who are evading taxes with accounts here that the UBS Bank is fully aware are set up specifically to illegally evade U.S. taxes. Not an avoidance scheme, not a legal scheme to pay less taxes, literally illegally evading. The U.S. government...
Kind of bossish, if you will.
Yeah, and the U.S. government got the names of these people and basically said, you have, you know, X amount of months...
So October of 2010 was the actual date. I was just reading something on this.
To close the account and to pay a fine in the amount that you owe, and I believe probably more... And
yeah, actually, I can answer that one. Paul Abrams wrote a great piece on this, who's a progressive activist, but also a businessman and a lawyer who's been, you know, started a lot of his own businesses, let's just say. He's a friend, and he wrote some great pieces on this for the Huffington Post because he knows a lot about this. And so what it would be is you'd have to pay, you have your tax rate recalculated to pay taxes on everything that you didn't pay, but you also would have to pay a 25% penalty on the largest year. The largest year of that of tax evasion. Now, if you calculate all that out, he could have paid 0% for a lot of years there. Oh, but guess what? In 2010, when he had to make up all that money and pay the 25% penalty, then he would have gotten probably somewhere to above 13% all of those years. So all that stuff doesn't disqualify what Harry Reid said.
Right.
It could all actually be true.
And so today there was Jim Messina, Obama's campaign director, sent a letter to his counterpart on the Romney campaign and said, here's the deal. I know you guys are really upset that we keep asking for Mitt Romney's taxes. This is just hilarious. And so we will vow. And we know that you're afraid that if we ask for – you give us some, we're just going to ask for more and this and that. We will vow that if you give 5 years total – including the two that you have now, so just release the 3 years prior to that, plus, you know, the ones that you've promised. Because people have to remember, the Romney campaign has not released a full 2 years of taxes. They've released, like, a partial year and a half of taxes. They're vowing to release 2011. They only released – there's one part of 2010 they didn't release. So the Obama campaign asked for releases up to 2007, which is genius because, of course, they'll even have the opportunity, if what you're saying is correct, and I actually think this is what it is, they can even say, okay, I'll tell you what. How about 4 years? We're working with you. We're compromising.
Okay, we'll compromise. Just three. Really, right. It's 2009, man. Yeah. That's the year.
And
that's the year.
That's what Romney's very concerned to basically admit that he was a criminal.
Right. I mean, let's
he was
be honest
criminally
here.
Evading taxes and got off with a fine. I mean, I think that's.
Well, look, you pointed this out, and you know, in numerous segments we've done, how much more circumstantial evidence do you really need? Money in the Cayman, Swiss banks, whatever. Yes, he's got that. A history of finding ways to avoid taxes. You know, that have been deemed criminal eventually. The son of boss scheme that Marriott did, that even John McCain called a criminal scheme.
Right.
Okay, so we know that. You know, and the fact that he refuses to release these taxes and will only go back to 2010. Now, you know, if he went back to 2008, it would be 2007 that would be suspicious. Whatever year he stops at, anything less than giving at least 8-10 years of taxes, like most of these guys do, tells you there's something there. Don't you think if he could possibly have given 3 or 4, then or maybe 5 years, then he would have been able to say, look, I've given you 5 years, that's enough. And I think people would have accepted that and said, yeah, of course, that's enough, 5 years. Okay, it's not 10 like some guys do, but 5 years gives us a pretty good idea. There has to be something that you have to know that if you don't go beyond 2010, that you give 1 year of taxes, that tells people something. There's something there in 2009. This seems to be by far the most logical thing. Of course, people point out the other thing is potentially that the stock market crashed around that time. And so with all of his write-offs, he easily could have had a 0% tax burden, and now he'd be lying about that because he said he's paid at least 13% taxes. But being that he's now said that, that gives me even more circumstantial evidence that it's what we're talking about, that it's the whole UBS thing and that it's the tax amnesty and he was criminally liable. And again, and when he gives the answer, I've been really pleased with the Obama campaign so far because they haven't run a normal Democratic campaign where they silo their messages of attack and don't create a grand narrative around who the opposition is, who they are and what they stand for and why those two things are intrinsically linked. And they've done that this time. Who Mitt Romney is, the type of guy he is who offshores jobs and is greedy and the rest. And that you can tell that. Let's take a look at his taxes. And it brought you to one of his biggest vulnerabilities, his lack of paying taxes. Well, the next commercial to keep this alive that's so obvious to me has got to be the Paul Ryan one. Because not only now is there plenty of evidence out there that Paul Ryan may have been involved in insider trading, and that's not as clear. Lynn Paramore wrote a great piece for Alternate because first this came out, then it was debunked by people.
Let me just stop you here just to let people know what you're talking about, that Paul Ryan sold stocks on the day that he was called to a meeting with Paulson et al., and to be informed about this crisis that was going on. And the stocks that he sold were specifically, I think he sold everything except for Goldman Sachs.
Right, which Henry Paulson happened to have gotten a waiver to talk to Goldman Sachs and knew that they were doing okay.
Right.
So you have to believe is that here's the key thing that Lynn Paramore wrote about, which the people who debunked it, and I have all the respect in the world for TPM and other people that debunked it and said it couldn't have happened. But remember when I came clean a few weeks ago on your show and admitted that I worked for Lehman Brothers and how these things worked? Well, insiders can get trades done in a split second if they really want to, if you know the right people. Wall Street works in an accelerated way the way the rest of the world works. I think we've all found that out, even people who didn't know that the last few years. I will tell you right now that it's become clear that the Bush administration called over to Nancy Pelosi and said, we need to come over and talk to you, Bernanke and Paulson, at 2:30 that day, well before the closing bell. If you believe for a second they called their political enemy before they called their own people at the top to say, we need to come over and huddle with you because J.P. Morgan and some of these other guys are in serious trouble, I've got a lunar colony I'd like to sell you. So all it would take is Paulson making a call to Paul Ryan, who's the budget committee guy, who's the head of the budget committee, and saying, this is going to be bad, and the economy is all these banks are going to come crashing down. Calling, even if they just called him at the same time they called Nancy Pelosi at 2:30, again, plenty of time before the closing bell to get in those trades. And it's Paulson who you're talking to, who worked for Goldman Sachs. He can either wink and nod at you that Goldman Sachs is doing fine, or he can come right out and say it. There's no law against insider trading at that point for these guys.
Right.
And there you go. I mean, it's such an easy, again, it's another one of these scenarios. It's so easy, and you've seen it happen so many times, that to believe that it couldn't have happened is to be naive. Well, it also came out, that Mitt Romney is sitting here saying, here's something that is obvious, that the Obama people might stay away from the insider trading thing because there's questions there. There's no question about this. Paul Ryan put his financial disclosure statements together, and oops, he just forgot to include the $1 to $5 million trust left to his wife that was providing somewhere up to $150,000 a year in income for them. I know that's small potatoes. So to some people, that's actually not a bad amount of money. And he just forgot to do that. And so upon sharing his tax returns with Mitt Romney, he had to amend that because the tax returns showed something his financial disclosure statement did not show.
These guys are just unbelievable.
What is the lesson that you learn from that? The lesson I learned is if you have to share your taxes, maybe your financial disclosure statements aren't fully accurate. So when Ann Romney tells you people that they've already shown all their financial disclosures and that tells you everything, well, look at what Paul Ryan just did with his financial disclosures. The FEC is toothless and doesn't do anything about these kinds of things. These things are rife with errors, constantly. Remember Clarence Thomas not sharing that his wife made $750,000 a year, or in 1 year, I think it was, or maybe it was over a couple years, from Heritage and these Tea Party groups? Whatever happened to Clarence Thomas? Was he impeached? Did he get in any legal trouble for that? Of course not.
Yeah, so, I mean, and we haven't even touched upon Paul Ryan's liability on social issues. People don't realize that this guy is about as a right winger nut job on social issues as you can get.
Yeah, He was the co-sponsor. I mean, again,
well,
just to finish that last thing, I was just saying that to me, the next ad should be something about, well, if Paul Ryan can't tell the truth in his disclosures, how can we trust Mitt Romney told the truth in his release your taxes kind of thing?
I honestly think what's going on now, and we just got a minute here. Honestly think what's going on now is that the Obama campaign is basically every day communicating to their counterparts, to Mitt Romney. Maybe Mitt Romney's the only one who knows, but they know, what is that dark secret that is in Mitt Romney's closet. And I actually think they're trying to drive him insane.
Well, it's a great campaign strategy. People forget that campaigns are like anything else. You know, if you can knock your opponent off their game by freaking them out, then that's one way you win. I mean, you're trying to surprise them. You're trying to screw with them mentally. I mean, that's a big part of the whole thing. So I think you're right. I think they may know, and they may just be messing with them, you know. But I didn't want to – I know you've got just a minute or less, and so I'll just say quickly that, yeah, because you brought up the social issues. Yes, Paul Ryan is 100% anti-gay in his voting record. He was a co-sponsor of what would be the personhood amendment, which I think is – that a life begins after the first pickup line at a bar.
Right. Well, I mean, damn close. I mean, we're talking a zygote. We're talking zygotes, folks.
I think we're pre-zygote now. I mean, we're almost at like, he smiled at me. I'm pregnant. We better stop the pregnant. You know, better as of right now, I can be considered pregnant. In Paul Ryan's world, remember, this is a personhood amendment that was rejected in Mississippi.
Yep.
Which is, you know, somewhat of a more conservative place. This guy is nuts. He's nuts, and he wanted hospitals to be able to turn away people that needed an emergency abortion to survive.
Yep.
As in, you know, so live. Just, you know, he may not talk about that stuff as much, but people should know that's where he stands on these types of issues.
All right. Well, Cliff, as always, a tremendous pleasure. I have a feeling we'll have a lot more to say next week at this time. We will be just days away, I guess, from the Republican convention, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
And
are you going to the Democratic convention?
I'm not. I don't think I'm going to either right now.
Okay.
I mean, it may change, but I don't think so.
Well, don't go to the Republican one, but I'll start plugging this. Maybe I can plug it right now that I'm going to be hosting the live stream of DFA, Democracy for America's coverage there.
Oh.
So I'm going to be interviewing people all day.
Where? In the Republican convention?
No, the Democratic one.
Okay,
so I will
good.
Be at the tent there, sponsored by which is really like a 25,000 square foot space, from what I'm told, by Netroots Nation and DFA's involved and whatever. So if you can make it down, Sam, I would love to. Well, you know, we maybe will do it via Skype too, but I definitely want to interview you.
All right,
and
great.
Well, and everybody watch it.
Then
of course.
Hopefully, I'll be able to talk to you as well. Maybe we can do a simulcast or something like that, so I can get.
That's what I'm talking about.
All right, sweet. Well, we'll talk about that. We'll figure it out. Cliff Schechter, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, buddy.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I'll be talking to Hari Kondabolu, and he will give me a movie selection. And also, this could get a little bit hairy because, well, maybe I'll tell the story when he gets on, but it turns out an old friend of mine is his boss, and that friendship is a little bit shaky. So Hari could be putting his entire professional career in jeopardy by showing up on the show. So he doesn't realize that yet. It's going to be sort of young guy. It's going to be sort of sad to tell him that when he gets on. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be right back.
Time for a report. We are the majority, not the sheeple. We are the majority. We the people. Why do we walk the walk? Why do we talk the talk? Why don't we just deny? If it's in your warranty, why? That's why.
All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. I mentioned that I realized in the course of booking Hari that when he said to me, he was like, I got to check with my boss, the head writer of the show. I work on the show. I got to check with my boss to see if I can do this. And I realized that I knew his boss, and apparently he's on the phone right now. Chuck, is that you, Chuck Sklar?
Sam Cedar, how are you, man?
The head writer of Totally Biased with Kamal Bell?
Yes, that's correct. That
Chuck,
is correct.
This is the first time we've talked in what, like 4 years?
Seven or eight. I don't know. How long have you been married?
I've seen you since then. Chuck is still mad that I didn't invite him to the wedding.
I'm actually not still mad. I know I'm against all marriages, so it's not a big deal.
All right.
How's everything going, man? How's the show?
Well, it's good. I mean, it's certainly not. It's not improving with this type of conversation. You got to be a little bit.
I'm not pushing anything. I'm not prepared for this. I'm merely acting as Hardy's receptionist.
Well, that's very. How's the gig over there? How's it going?
It's great. It's great. I don't know if anybody's seen Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell on FX Thursdays after Louis at 11 o'clock.
I watched it last night. I enjoyed it. Saw Rachel Maddow on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Thanks, man. I'm glad you liked it. It's been good, and Kamau's great. Hari, not so good. But
right. I was going to tell. All right, so put Hari on the phone. Have Hari give you my email address, will you? So let's go get a drink. I didn't even realize you were in New York.
All right, man. I'll talk to you off the radio.
See what the hesitation in that? What? I'm talking to the guys.
All right, man.
All right, we'll talk
Bye.
To you soon. Bye.
Hey, Sam Cedar.
Hey, Hari. Thank you so much for doing this. Sorry I've just ruined your career.
It's done.
Listen, when Chuck fires you, you're going to have a good story, and it will not be hard for you to rebound from this. Let me put it out. And had I known that this was going to go this way, I would have waited till you were off the show. First off, Hari,
right.
I met Hari when we were both auditioning for some Comedy Central project that never developed.
Which is a shame because the format is great. It's like the BBC panel shows, and
yes.
you were hosting it, and it was fantastic.
Yes, I mean I cannot tell you how many failed BBC panel shows have I been a part of that have never gone anywhere. But and so I was saying in the intro that I've wanted you to come on for a while, and then I think I saw you tweet about. The W. Kamau Bell show, and it just reminded me that I wanted to watch that show and have you on. And then you said, I got to check with my boss, and I realized, wait a second. Chuck is the – I heard Chuck was the head writer of that show. Now, you don't understand. Now, I don't know how well you can read Chuck, but right now he's seething in it with anger. And he's mad at me. And he's really mad at you. Now,
for doing what? What do we do?
Well, look, I'm not saying it's rational, but Chuck was very angry that I didn't invite him to the wedding. He was in L.A. We were a little bit out of touch. There's only so many people you can invite to your wedding. I didn't think he would want to even come. I mean, who's going to come all the way from California? And then he was very angry about it. And I heard about it from a lot of people. He pretends like he's not mad now. But I saw him since then once or twice, and he was clearly angry. And when I brought it up on the phone 2 minutes ago, he's angry. Is he there in the room with you now?
No, he's not. I am alone in a room.
Yeah. I got news for you. What happens after this conversation may not work out so well for you.
Sam Cedar, why would you do this?
I was like, oh Jesus, I shouldn't do this to him. But, how's the show?
It was great.
It was
going really well. the show, it has been great. The first two episodes, like, we feel really positive about. And, we have six shows right now. We hope the network picks us up. And we feel like we're building a nice base, both, like, at the live, actual tapings as well as on the internet. And we know we do a unique thing. It's very blunt, and it's not like we're doing a fake news kind of thing. It's
right.
Pretty, this is Kamau's point of view, and he's direct about it. And the way it's shot, in some ways it feels like stand up, but with visuals. And he's so good. And it's funny because I know he's an incredible performer, and he's my friend, and I've seen Kamau for a few years, and I know what he can do. But every time he does it, rehearsal is different from the actual experience of being in front of an audience and having energy. Once the audience is there and he checks in, it's like, oh my God, this is why this guy has a show.
Right.
He just knows how to put it on. And yesterday was another thing. We wrote some stuff.
So I didn't realize,
First
off, I didn't realize it was in New York. Second off,
yeah.
I didn't realize that it was actually, you guys must tape this just hours before it airs, right?
Yes. That's right. We tape it at 3 o'clock every Thursday at the Manhattan Center. So if you want to come to a live taping, you certainly are able to.
No,
I might have to join you in the audience. It's we edit and we send it off to LA, and then that's that.
Who was the first guest on the show last week?
First guest was Chris Rock, executive producer.
Okay.
We had Rachel Maddow on last night.
Yeah. And then who's next?
The surprise.
We haven't
put it out there yet, but so far so good. And I think the thing that people really like too are the people on the street pieces, the man on the street stuff. We had a stop and frisk piece the first week where Kamau was in Harlem talking to people about their experiences with stop and frisk and racial profiling. And that's the kind of thing we want to do. It's honest. It's people's perspectives. It's somewhat written in terms of there are some little funny sketch pieces to it. What are the things could you put in your pockets if you're going to get frisked? But it wasn't, a lot of it was let people share their stories. It's great. This is the kind of show that, Kamau envisioned. And it's funny. I remember being in a cafe in San Francisco with Kamau and Nato and talking about what would a show look like, and now we have it. And how often does that happen, So,
well, in my experience, never.
Right. Out of San Francisco as well. That's another thing. Kamau, I don't think of another example of a dude who wasn't in LA or New York, came from San Francisco, busted his ass to actually have a vision and have a clear voice and get discovered and moves to New York for the show. He's it's a great story.
Right,
so.
It is a great story. I mean, from his perspective. I mean, there's a lot of us out here who just resent that.
Right. What? He got ample stage time in another city where he was loved and adored, and he made it here by earning it somewhere else?
Yeah, that's
not bitter? How is he not bitter? Yeah.
And of course, we all know that Chuck Sklar has had a tremendous amount of experience with Stop and Frisk.
Why are you trying to hurt me? I feel like I'm caught in the divorce. I'm the child caught in the divorce, and somehow I'm being hit by both sides. I didn't do nothing.
I know. I had no idea. It's really going to be sad, but I really feel like at least you'll be able to put this. I don't know if there's going to be there'll be some type of redress or some type of appeal you can make. But you can maybe there's some type of maybe you'll have some type of grounds for a lawsuit, but at least you're going to have six out of it. You'll have a fun time in New York, and then you just call this one. But it is. I have to say that FX. I've been sort of pleasantly surprised with they had. The Russell Brand show, which wasn't necessarily my cup of tea, but I appreciated the perspective that it was coming from. And
cup of tea, he's British, very good.
Yeah, there you go. I know Stoller, who was his sidekick, and I'm a fan of Stoller's politics as well. But it is this is really it's pushing it. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I've seen, Chris Rock sort of got away with some of this stuff too. And, Bill Maher has a very, but on basic cable or
yes.
To have, someone who is so aggressively liberal, not, you know, I mean, totally biased. It's built into the title. But I mean, it's, I don't know. I
think that helps, though. I think because there's a clarity, like, right. You know what you're going to see. And if this isn't for you, well, you knew from the get go. And, you know, I mean, that helps, I think. And yeah, I think maybe that's part of the reason why it is working and people are loving it, is because it hasn't been out there before in this way. I think he's so blunt, and his perspective also is broad. You know, like we're talking about race, of course, right. But you know, we're also, you know, we have a piece on gay marriage coming out soon. You know, we talk about Islamophobia. I think the work we did with the Sikh shooting, the first show, I'm really proud of us for that, because nobody else really addressed that comedically or in the media properly. So it was, you know, we were on that, and it was important for us. Like we said, like, this is important to cover, and we have to find a way to get some jokes in, because this has to be addressed. And I thought, you know, he did the best job he could. I thought he was very playful, and really by breaking down the differences between Sikhs and Sheikhs, as Romney said, and Muslims. And you know, that's what we want to do. We have to find a way to address the hard things. So
it's pretty amazing what's happening in terms of political comedy right now, because political comedy, when I was doing stand-up, was essentially Barry Crimmins, and then the only sort of even arguably political comedy show was Politically Incorrect, which was – really, I mean, at that time, from almost the other end of the spectrum, not fully, right. But you know, Bill Maher, when he started, was sort of like more of a libertarian, like his comedy wasn't sort of libertarian in terms of like economic libertarianism, but it was more like, nobody's going to stop me from saying stuff that is, you know, rude. And that was basically it for, and he over the years has sort of, has become more liberal, or his show has become more liberal. I don't quite know, but, there seems to be just a lot of opportunity, because you're a fairly political stand-up, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, I like the bigger social parts of it. Like, I don't like talking about the game aspect. You know what I mean? The political game aspect of it. Like, I like the
horse race politics, like right? I mean,
right. Like, yeah, guess. Like, so, I mean, yeah, but yeah, sure. I mean, like, you know, this show is a mix of both, and my stand up has a little bit of that as well. But yeah, I mean, it's, yes. I don't think there's anything else to say. Yes.
And how is that? I mean, how have you experienced that? I mean, do you go on the road a bit, or were you, I mean, what, just, I don't really know that much of your history in that regard.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Well, my background originally was as an immigrant rights organizer, and that's what I did as a profession in Seattle, working with people who were in detention, like immigrant detention.
I had no idea.
Yeah, victims of hate crimes. That was my background. And it was in Seattle, and I did stand-up, you know, on the side of something I loved. And it took off. I got discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival, and I was on Kimmel while I still had a job as an organizer. And so, you know, it's kind of a weird, it wasn't like I always focused on stand-up, and, you know, I had to decide whether I wanted to do this. I had these incredible opportunities. So when I actually started doing stand-up full-time in 2009, it was kind of, I had a weird trajectory, because I kind of went in with, I already have some credits and was in this world while I've never actually pursued it full time. And then I took a year off from comedy to get a master's in human rights from the London School of Economics. And I still was on the fence on whether I wanted to do stand up full time. It was like, I kind of, I'm an organizer. Do I want to give that up? And I'm not the only organizer on the show, by the way. Nato Green, who was also a writer on the show, organized with labor unions for 14 years in San Francisco, while also doing comedy. So he's on staff as well. So, you know, we're a weird show in that regard. You know, it's not just seasoned comedy writers, that we have that as well.
Are you telling me that most comedy shows don't have good community organizing skills in terms of backgrounds
master's degrees? Since Matt TV, not since Matt TV. No, it hasn't.
That's amazing. I had no idea about any of that. That's fantastic.
So yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. In terms of gigs, like, you know, I kind of go all over the place. I do some clubs. I do a lot of colleges, which, you know, when I initially started doing colleges, I thought, oh, this is great because, you know, that's what like Carlin wanted to do. And that's what, you know, just doing gigs in front of audiences that give a shit. And then you get there and you realize, oh my God, kids are stupid. it's not a universal that just because you're young and passionate that you're young, passionate and, you know, read the paper or like know what's going on in the world, or it doesn't mean anything. So sometimes you'll get amazing shows out of that. And sometimes you're just so, wow. Like, cause like think about this, like there was a time where you didn't see any comedy and the only comedian you'd ever see was when they came to your town or to your college or whatever. And now, you know, there's tons of comedy. Constantly, right. Like stand up on TV, and stand up on TV is a very different thing than the live experience. You know, it's not going to be as polished. It's going to be messy. You're going to dig yourself into holes and try to get yourself out. That's what makes it fun. And so I think, you know, especially with young people who aren't experienced that much and except television, like it can be a bit of a pain. And especially when you're talking about things that aren't usually fodder for comedy and the way I approach it. So like this show, I think in part, we're hoping to also open up some of the discussion. So, you know, when we do live shows and stuff, we have people who get what the topics are. And hopefully, you know, this is part of a change, you know, in the topics people feel comfortable discussing critically and be funny about. I think a lot of ways we think of ourselves as like, you know, a comedy show with Rachel Maddow doing the research. You know what I mean? Like, uh-huh. It's like... That's a big part of it. Like, how can we be funny Maddow, you know? So
who else do you guys, who else do you guys watch over there, or who do you not like?
Not like meaning?
Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, when you guys are shitting around saying, when you guys are sitting around saying that Maddow is great, but you know who sucks?
Oh, I mean it's not other like artists or other, you know.
I'm not saying artists. I'm talking broadcasters.
We're not huge Pat Buchanan fans.
Come on,
that's what you're saying.
That's low hanging fruit. Come on.
You know, it's kind of irrelevant because we don't that kind of like hate is it doesn't help us write. You know, I mean, with her, like it's like this is inspiring stuff that lets us think about how we can frame ideas and thoughts and put jokes in there. But I don't think
nobody sits around and goes like I was watching Blankety Blank last night and that guy is horrible.
I mean, what good does that do?
Wait. I'm not saying it does any good. I'm saying it's a room full of comedians. And the idea that, you know what? This did strike me last night. Like, Rachel came on and said to Kamal, like, I feel like comedians are out there judging me when I try and make jokes. And I know that's true. I mean, I'm not saying I judge her in that regard, but I know that's true. Of course. And Kamal was like, you hang out with the wrong comedians. And I was like, wait a second. He's lying now. He's lying.
What? That's not like we are a different breed. I mean, it's a funny thing. When I moved to New York, I remember being frustrated in part because it felt like after shows there were very few people I could talk to in a real way. It was always like, you know, hey, you read about this thing and here's five jokes. No, I want to have a conversation. And as opposed to like Seattle or San Francisco, where I didn't feel a certain bitterness and meanness because, you know, first of all, this is an industry town like LA is. So everybody wants something and they're here for a reason, whether you're an open micer or, you know, seasoned professional, you want something. When you're in San Francisco or Seattle or a place that doesn't have the same industry, you know, what are you really fighting for? You want to be the best you can be, maybe some road gigs, but it's a different kind of atmosphere. So, you know, you have a
I think that also has to do with the West Coast.
Seattle and San Francisco.
I mean, I was in Boston in the early 90s and, you know, completely hanging around exclusively with comedians. Chuck was one of them. I think at one point.
Right.
I think at one point I either lived with Chuck or we were definitely too close for comfort. And I went to San Francisco for about 6 to 8 months at that time. And the vibe in San Francisco was definitely different. Like, I would go to movies with other comedians and didn't feel the same sort of oppression that I felt really comfortable with in Boston. Maybe it's just sort of like an East-West Coast thing. But, I mean, I feel more – I mean, it was a little almost disconcerting.
I'm built more for that. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody talks shit because we're human, but I think, you know, it's different here. The culture of our office, it's very, it's like group writing.
But
and
how is that possible with Chuck?
Okay, I'm not getting involved any further in your quarrel.
Well, honestly, but honestly, listen, this is what I want you to do. I'm going to say something. You don't have to agree or disagree. You cough once if you agree. You cough twice if you disagree.
This is me in 5 years. Oh, God, I shouldn't have coughed. Why did I cough? I actually cleared my throat. I lost my job to a cough. Clearing my throat.
Right. Well, I will spare you.
I'm in grad school again.
I will spare you that. I'm not going to endanger your career anymore. We can move on to the movie portion of the thing.
Sure.
I just got to say that Chuck, in my experience, one of the most bitter human beings I've ever met. And, you know, I don't want you to have to respond to that. I will go right into the movie section of the program. I'm joking, of course, because I'm hoping that Chuck will ultimately hear this and get upset about it. But Chuck once said to me, and this is, you know, this is 15 years ago. He said, you need to have a talk show where there's no guest and all we see is your mouth moving. And that's ultimately, I have to say, that's ultimately basically what happened. We should actually contemplate.
He's a visionary.
He is a visionary in some sorts, in very narrow context. In other areas, he seems to have like some, you know, his sight is not exactly 20/20, if you know what I'm talking about. And you know what I'm talking about because you've been around Chuck for more than a day. So you know exactly what I'm talking about. And we don't have to say anything more. listen to the silence.
Hold on. I'm going to monster.com right now. Give me a second.
All right. So, Hari, here's the idea, is that I can't leave my house to see a movie anymore. I haven't seen a movie in a theater, I don't know, probably since before the last time I saw Chuck, because I have a wife and a daughter who do not allow me to go out of the house for anything that does not in some way bring revenue in. And so I, you know, in the middle of the night, I get to watch like a Netflix or an Amazon movie on my Roku or my Google TV, which I use sometimes, and maybe even my Apple TV, which I get because I'm cutting that cord. The cord has been cut. So, what do you suggest I watch? And I'll tell you, I knew that you would be able to come up. Well, I don't want to put any pressure on you, but I thought like you struck me as very smart, and I liked. I'm not incredibly familiar with your comedy, but to the extent that I've seen it, I appreciate it. But now knowing that you also have a master's degree and a history of community organizing, this is going to be a great movie pick, I think, without putting any pressure on you.
Sure, sure. Let me think for a second. Well, certainly, I think you should watch Good Hair if you haven't, but that Chris Rock made with Chuck Sklar, I think, actually. And Chuck made
Good
Hair. Helped make that.
Oh, I should say, you know, Chuck Sklar was in one of Louis's first, I think it was his first feature called Tomorrow Night. Chuck is the lead in that. Have you ever seen that, Hari?
No, he told me about that. Actually,
I'm sure.
I haven't.
I'm sure he told you about it.
He was Bin Laden in an episode of Louie, too, I think. First season, I think?
I think that's
he
possible.
He played Bin Laden.
Yeah.
I just saw the ESPN 30 for 30 on Reggie Miller and the Knicks. I thought that was great.
Is that streaming on Netflix, Hari? Come on.
It is streaming on Netflix. I saw it on Netflix the other night. It's very good.
I get the feeling you didn't take it seriously. You didn't take.
Did you want something more human rights? Is that what you wanted?
No, I want something. That's, come on. Good hair. That's
okay,
it.
Just okay.
Emailed
okay.
This in.
Okay. I'll give you some.
Chuck.
Have you
obviously,
ever seen,
Chuck got to you before this piece.
Have you ever seen Lagan?
No. What's this?
There you go. I don't know if it's streaming because I don't have Netflix. I use my brother's account. But Lagan is a Bollywood film.
Hold on for a second. We just got. We just had some breaking news. Ari Kondabolu is ripping off Netflix. I wonder how the VP of acquisitions that I know, Name Drop Friday, Ted Sarandos, will take that when I talk to him next.
Man, every single person who has Netflix.
I've just
now
destroyed your entire
you, so
life.
There are neighborhoods that
you're
going to
get fired from
Netflix
your job.
Account.
You're going to go home and you're going to have no access to Netflix. And then your brother's also going to get in trouble. Okay, what was the movie? Now tell me what the name was.
Majority Report. Lagan.
Lagan.
Lagan. It's a Bollywood film. It is one of the rare films that handles both cricket and colonialism at the same time.
Sweet.
It is fantastic. It's about a group of villagers who can't pay a tax that the British are putting on them because they tax them grain, and they're double the tax 1 year, which they couldn't afford the single tax. And they stand up and they end up having to play a cricket match against them. Apparently, it's based on a true story. And if they win, they don't need to pay tax for 3 years. But if they lose, they have to pay triple tax, which would basically kill everybody.
Wow.
So there's a stake. There's a stake in it for them to win. And it's a fantastic film. Solid acting. It really gives you a lot of the complex. At least it's still a Bollywood film, so it's not the heaviest shit necessarily. But there's it gives you a good sense of some of the major issues and themes that have happened in India throughout history and now still. Caste issues and rural India and colonialism, love of cricket, and it's an incredible sports movie. So if you like sports, this is like. It's a long film, but it's also an incredible build-up to a fantastic end. So, and there's songs in it, too, because it's a Bollywood film. So
sweet.
Yeah.
I mean, apparently it's not streaming on Netflix, but maybe it is on Amazon.
Did you check
Amazon? But that sounds great. I mean, I have a slight affinity for cricket, and the rest of it sounds very interesting. Well, Harry, maybe I will not let Netflix know that you're ripping them off.
Because I give you a good suggestion.
Yeah.
Even if you don't know cricket, like the rules are kind of explained through like the writing, through like characters talking to each other and different things that happen in the film. So, even for people who've never seen a cricket match or don't know how to play it, you can follow along easily enough.
Fantastic. So. Well, Harry, yeah. What's your website? Do you have a website?
I do have a website. You can it's HariKondabolu.com, which no one will spell. I think if you type in HariTheComic.com, it'll redirect to HariKondabolu.com.
We've got it linked on Majority.fm, which is very easy, easy to spell for people.
And of course, Twitter. That'd be cool, people.
Oh yeah.
Started.
And we'll put your Twitter feed up there as well. And it's on Thursday nights is totally biased with W. Kamal Bell.
And I'm on TV tonight, actually. I'm on John Oliver's New York stand-up show on Comedy Central tonight at 11.
Wow, this worked out quite well for everybody involved, I think.
Yeah, it did.
I had no idea. Tell Chuck, give Chuck my, give Chuck my number, too, because I think he probably purged it from his contact list a long time ago. He won't listen to this. Chuck won't listen to this, unless you tell him that we talked about him. So you don't have to say anything. You can just say like he didn't even bring up your name. He just said make sure that Chuck calls me because I really want to go have a drink with him. If you say that I said anything about Chuck, he will listen to it. I don't even think he knows how to work an iPod, and he will do it.
Yeah, I'll give him your number. All right.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it, buddy.
Right,
good luck.
Take care.
I hope I didn't ruin your life.
Bye, then.
Bye. Oh, boy. I feel badly. That's going to be a problem. It's going to be a real problem for him. I mean, if I had known, you know, because it was late at night when I got back, heard back from him. He's like, I got to check with my boss. And I realized, like, oh, my God, his boss is Chuck. And then, you know, what am I going to say? Like, I don't want to, if I say at that point, like, I shouldn't book you because I'm going to end up saying something about Chuck that could get you in trouble. Then that's going to get back to Chuck and it's going to be just as problematic for him. Right? I mean, well, what are you going to do?
What could you do?
What could you do? I did my best. We have, folks, like a phoenix rising from the dead. Don't we have a song from Jimmy Reefer Cake? He sent like I don't know how many songs he sent, but they were like 15 minutes long. It's like he sent like a like Anagata Davida.
The one he sent today was just way too, well, one of the ones he sent was just way too long. What are you thinking, Jimmy? What are you thinking?
All right, but let's play. What is the one that we're gonna play?
Get High Again, Mr. President.
There you go. Get High Again, Mr. President from Jimmy Reefer Cake, folks. We'll please become a member of the show. where do you get this type of entertainment, political analysis on Fridays? If you're one of those people who just listens on Fridays, and there seems to be less of you, or I should say, more of you seem to be listening over the course of the week. Now, we don't have specific data on that, but. I have sent our data to forensic auditors, and that's what they have come back with. We actually spent 45% of our budget this year on forensic auditors to look at, to examine our data. And the only thing they came up with, it seems like people are listening to more than just Fridays. Those people who would just listen on Fridays seem to be listening like on Wednesdays and Thursdays or Tuesdays and Thursdays now, whatever. Point is, on Fridays, we do, with Cliff, particularly now, it seems like we do a lot more sort of like horse racy, I don't know how, I mean, for us, horse racy stuff. But I don't know where else, where you can get the rest of the content that you get over the course of the week, and frankly, the depth of the conversation that Cliff and I have, and then, you know, movie recommendations from very interesting people. And then songs occasionally.
Well, to defend Friday, I don't think you'll hear the topics presented anywhere else in such an entertaining way.
Indeed. Thank you. Thank you for putting it that way. Please become a member at Majority FM, majority.fm. We really need your support. And, of course, there's other ways in which you can support this program, and I will tell you them after we listen to this Jimmy Reefer Cake Song of the Week.
The hell, President Obama, such a fine sight to see. You're the first U.S. black president, and that made me happy. Yeah, you said you inhaled, and that was the point. So why don't you tell me, man, why don't you light up yourself a joint and just get high? You need to get high again. Get high. President Obama, I'm sick and tired of it. Every single one of you goddamn politicians is a hypocrite. Behind every hypocrisy, there's a big fat lie. Marijuana won't make you crazy.
No.
And it never did make anybody die.
That's
so
right.
So why don't you smoke a big fat joint and get high, Mr. President? Why don't you get high again? Get high again.
There you have it, folks. Jimmy Reefer Cake wants the president to get high again. And
that was very good.
I thought it was a good song.
That was
very sweet.
That was very Brad from Sublime-esque. The late singer from Sublime. You know, he's like when he would break out the acoustic guitar.
Uh-huh.
It was very – that's what it reminded me of.
All right. You know what it reminded me of? Jimmy Reefer Cake. What's that? Oh, yeah, of course. You know what? But I don't even know where that is in my button thing anymore.
Wow.
I don't know what happened to... how about we... Hey, you know, I got to fix this. I don't know where...
So we'll clap in the office then.
How about this? Wow! All right, Jimmy Reaper Cake. All right, folks, you can support this program. Of course, becoming a member is the best thing to do from our perspective, but also you can support this program by buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get great fair trade organic coffee, tea, chocolate if you want. 10% coupon code MAJORITY. Get the Majority FM blend. People rave about it. If you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support the show. Give us a iTunes review. Give us a... donate your account. All sorts of different things. Please, your support keeps this program going. All right, folks. See you in the better half of the program. You can call me at 646-257-3920 or IM me at Majority FM.